This meeting to order of Hess. We do have four members present. Senator Thomas, Senator Calgary, Senator Dyson, and myself, Betty Davis. And we do have one bill that we're going to take up. It's not going to take very long. It's been heard before, and it's just a matter of us hearing the difference in the bill that we have before us now and what we also heard several weeks ago. And hopefully we're going to be able to pass this out of this committee into the Finance Committee, I think it is. It's the longevity bonus. And what is the bill number?
40.
Okay.
Yes.
Senate Bill 40. Okay. Senator, you ready to present?
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Wilikowski. I am the Senator for Northeast Anchorage. Good afternoon, and I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 40, Longevity Bonus Reapplications. Senator Davis, members of the committee will recall that this bill was originally heard by this committee on February 7th this year, whereupon members of the governor's administration expressed support for the bill, both restoring the longevity bonus and for passage of this legislation as the appropriate vehicle to do so. It was determined that certain technical changes would be necessary in order for the Department of Health and Social Services to administer this program. We requested these changes in writing from the department, and upon receiving them, we distributed them to each member of the committee for review. That you have those changes in your packet. The proposed legislation allows former longevity bonus recipients to reapply for the bonus until January 1, 2008 and receive the same level of benefits as they had previously. This recommendation will prevent individuals from being disqualified due to not providing monthly applications while the program was not in operation. Those changes have now been incorporated into the latest draft CS, which I believe you have before you through a joint effort of the Legislative Legal Services, the Department of Law, and the Department of Health and Social Services. At this time, with your permission, I would like to turn over the testimony to Tam Cook of Legislative Legal Services to explain the exact differences in the wording of the two CSs. If it's okay with you, Madam Chair, I'd...
Yes.
Thank you.
Very good.
Through the chair, for the record, I'm Tamara Cook from the Legislative Affairs Agency, and the changes that I've been asked to identify, I think, are those as between a C draft that you considered and the current one that you have, which is the E draft. The changes appear on the very first page, and they consist of line 10. If you look at line 10, it has to do with the eligibility of who's going to be able to reapply. The people that will be able to reapply are those who either received a longevity bonus payment for June of 2003 or people who had did not receive the bonus but who had filed the notice that they were going to be outside of the state during the month of June, and as a result of that they didn't get the bonus. So there is that change. The other change is on lines 12 and 13. The original CS required a maintenance of continuous residency during the period between June 30th, 2003, the last bonus day, and the date of reapplication. At the request of the department, that was changed so that for purposes of reapplying, the person who applies must be a resident at the time that they sign the reapplication form and date it. And so that change appears on lines 12 and 13. Mm-hmm. It's my understanding, I think that this completely addressed the concerns that the Department of Hess had with the bill. Are there any questions?
Any questions from members? Yes, Senator Cowery?
So if a person, on your last statement on 12 mm-hmm. and 13, if they have been out of the state for a year or two, they could come back at that date and sign it and be a recipient of a bonus. Is that the way you read it?
Senator Cowdery, that would be correct, but they would still need to be a state resident.
Yes.
When they signed it. Right now, just as a matter of interest, there is a provision in the longevity bonus program that states that if a person is continuously absent for 3 years, they're permanently disqualified.
Right.
And that provision has not been exempted in this bill.
One brother, last.
Yes.
To the sponsor, what are you, what is your idea of the source of funding to come from?
Well,
the general fund?
General funds, yes.
General fund?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
You done? Is there anybody from the department that wanted to speak to this bill?
Need a motion? Oh, got one.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Stacy Crayley, and I'm with the Department of Law, and I'm here on behalf of both the Department of Law and Department of Health and Social Services to answer any questions that you may have. We did work with Ms. Cook on these amendments and agree with them and feel that it solves the technical difficulties we felt existed in reinstating the program. So if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I don't have anything else to add.
All right. Thank you very much. There is a question.
Thank you, Senator Davis. Just one short question anyhow. Is the definition of a resident for these purposes the same as it is for a permanent fund?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, yes, the premise that we came up with, including the sign and date, be present in the state on the date that you sign and date to your application, we wanted to track the permanent fund process, so that is part of that, but it would be the same eligibility. You'd have to be, you know, a resident of the state with the intent to remain, and I believe that's how the language was amended.
For the same time frame as well?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cowdery?
Yeah, I was a recipient of the longevity bonus, and at that time, whenever we received a check, we had to sign, they sent us something we had to send back in before we got our next check. That has been addressed in the law?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, the way I understand it is that in the past, when the longevity bonus program existed previously, you would receive your check, and then there was a stub that you had to sign and resend in as your continuous eligibility, and I think it was something to that effect. That continuous eligibility will still be required prospectively, but this technical fix allows for those individuals who haven't been sending in their monthly check stubs because there was nothing to send in to become eligible again.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure to clear that up.
Oh, if there are no other questions, there's one piece of business that we need to take care of. This has not been accepted by the body. The work draft.
I'm out of E. Path. Oh. I make a motion that we accept for
CS.
Work draft committee substitute for Senate Bill 40 that's before us.
Is that okay with everyone?
Yes.
It's accepted. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody in the audience that wanted to speak to this bill? I don't have a signed up list. I assume that it isn't. And if no one is ready to testify any further than they have already, it's my intention to move this bill to the next referral committee, which would be finance, I think.
Can I make a motion?
Yes, I do need a motion.
I make a motion to move committee substitute for Senate Bill 40 forward to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations. And I don't know if we have a fiscal note on it.
The fiscal note is not in here. I think he's getting it. It's the same as it was.
Yeah.
When we had the last meeting, it was not changed. And then it would be addressed in finance.
I'd ask for unanimous consent.
It's been moved that we accept the referral of this bill to the next committee. And if everyone would agree to that, we won't have to call the roll.
It's gone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're done. We do have the Department of Health and Social Services that's going to present to us today on a very special program. And we've taken part of their time. I'm going to ask that they come forward at this time so we can begin to get started on your presentation. We would like for you to state your names for the record. I don't recall what you said, who was going to go first.
Good morning. My name is Shirley Pitts, and I'm the Early Childhood Comprehensive Systems Coordinator.
Good afternoon. My name is Claudia Shanley, and I am the Systems Reform Administrator in the Office of Children's Services in the Department. And we would like to thank you, first of all. I realize this is the first time I've had to wear glasses during a presentation, so I'm on and off. I'm going to try to get used to it. We appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak to you about this initiative. About a month ago, Senator Davis accompanied us along with Representatives Wilson and Coghill to a meeting that was sponsored by the National Conference on State Legislatures in Chicago to hear about this initiative. Alaska, you'll hear more about how Alaska's been involved, but it was from that we received this request from you to present this information, so we're happy to do that. It is informational, we have no requests, but just want to inform you about how we've been trying to work with this program in within our division and in our communities. I think first and foremost, the strengthening families through early care and education is really funded through a foundation, a National Doris Duke Charitable Foundation. We in Alaska were chosen to participate in 2 years of technical assistance. So there wasn't any money involved other than the time of staff and community members to think about this project. Additionally, the technical assistance was offered through the Center for the Study of Social Policy, which is located in Washington, D.C. We're going to spend our time, I think we've allotted about 35 or 40 minutes to basically take you through some foundational information really quickly, talk specifically about the Strengthening Families Initiative, and then hear from one of our pilot sites in Alaska. So we thank you for your time in advance.
I'm going to use the microphone because I have a very soft voice and I tend to fade out. So I'd like to start with this morning just a little bit of foundation and background about why this program is so important. And you'll notice that the name of the program is Strengthening Families Through Early Care and Education, and it's really about child abuse prevention, and that's what the program is designed to focus on, as you'll see as we go through this. But I'm sure that you have been hearing some of this information about why the early years are so important, and the fact that our early years are sometimes the most important in terms of development. What we know is that young children come to us with all kinds of genetics when they're born, but we also know that what's really important in brain development is what happens experientially. So you put genetics and experiences together, and that really establishes sort of what we call the architecture of the brain. The quality of that architecture really makes a difference in terms of setting a foundation for what follows for children, their learning, their behavior, and their health. We also know that relationships are really the active ingredients in those experiences. And as you all know, kids who have nurturing, caring, loving relationships build healthy brain architecture. It's a very strong foundation for later on. But we also know that when those protective relationships aren't available for children and children experience persistent stress, that there are actually physiological changes that disrupt brain development, either impairing cell growth or interfering with our neural circuit development. So experiences become very important in terms of what happens with brain development, which then sets the foundation for lifelong learning. And it's very helpful for us to have some information about the biology of stress because it really explains some of the differences for children in terms of their behavior, in their physical and mental health, and especially when we're looking at kids who are experiencing child abuse and neglect, some of the brain changes and the physiological changes are important for us to understand. So we'd like to talk a little bit about three levels of stress, so we can help you understand a little bit about the differences in this. Positive stress is the first one, where kids, or us as adults even, experience moderate, sort of short-lived stress. And if you look at the face on this little boy, you know that his heart rate's up just a little bit. I mean, he's excited. He's like, oh, this is this new great thing I get to try here riding this bike. What's happening for his brain is this is probably not going to change too much because it's moderate stress, it's an exciting thing, and he comes back down to level shortly after this. We have what's called tolerable stress for children, and that's when stressful things happen. Perhaps it's a divorce in the family, maybe our favorite pet died. It's possible that this could interrupt brain development and disrupt that. But it's usually buffered for many children because they have supportive relationship. So kids go through hard times, as we do as adults, but they have supportive relationships that help that from being prolonged. The stress that concerns us most, particularly as it comes to child abuse and neglect or domestic violence, is what we call toxic stress. So it's strong, it's prolonged, and often there is not a supportive relationship to buffer this kind of stress. And often, as you may know, children who are in these situations are what we call hypervigilant. They're sort of sitting on the edge of their seat, prepared for what may come so they can protect themselves. This is the kind of stress that truly does physiological damage to a young child's brain. It's prolonged and it is not buffered with some of that protection that young children receive in more nurturing environments. With the Office of Children's Services Child Protection, our protective service reports for young children, we wanted to point out the percentages of these reports that are regarding young kids. We have 35% of our reports that are for children birth to 5 years of age, which becomes very critical when you include in this formula the biology of stress, knowing that this can impact a child's brain development and impact all kinds of things down the road. So what this science helps us, it sort of points us to a two-pronged approach to promoting healthy development. One is more of a universal or coordinated access to services for families and young children, where we can support families, we can facilitate child well-being, we can intervene early. The second approach is a more targeted intervention and provision of services who kids have already experienced toxic stress. Strengthening Families really is about the above program. It's a universal approach. It's available to all families, and hopefully it intervenes before children have experienced that high level of toxic stress on their brains. So this is just sort of a graphic. Where you see that if we want to really facilitate positive outcomes for children, we need to build in protective factors and minimize our risk factors. And the thing I think that this slide really helps to demonstrate is those the importance of those early years. You can see the trajectory at the beginning of this is much higher, has a steeper incline than when kids get older. And it just points to the importance of these first few years when most of the brain is developing that we do interventions. And as the child grows older, the enormity of that levels off a bit. It's not quite so profound. I'm going to turn this back to Claudia so she can talk with you more about the National Strengthening Families model.
So in the beginning, in 2001, the Center for the Study of Social Policy went about looking for a strategic, a feasible approach to child abuse prevention. They wanted to look at a systematic approach, one that was national in scope, one that addressed young children, very large numbers of young children, and would have impact long before that abuse or neglect ever happened. And whether it's a good thing or not a good thing. The reality is, in our state and across the country, more children, birth to age 5, are in some type of early care and education program between those ages. And so the center decided to go about looking at how can we do child abuse prevention through these early care and education programs. Some of the old ideas, I think that Shirley sort of talked about a little bit, include that idea of targeting at risk. The idea that you would look at characteristics that are common among the families experiencing child abuse and neglect and identifying families that need an intervention and promoting a program in that way. Also, a lot of times, whether we want to or not, it highlights bad parenting. The new idea and what the center was interested in doing was going where the kids already are, normalizing child abuse prevention. Rather than looking at it as targeting at-risk families, let's look about at interventions for everyone that makes sense, that are good supportive relationships. So the hypothesis was that the early care and education programs would be central to this effort because that's where kids are, because there is daily contact. Parents drop their kids off and pick them up every day. Providers, early care and education teachers, have the opportunity when children are in their care to talk with them, to nurture, to support, and likewise to do that with parents as well. And the last thing about early care and education programs is that it's an early warning sign. It's a place where if there may be signs of problems with families, they may come to light for those providers who see those parents and talk with them every day. And this slide just summarizes, I think, that we're looking at sort of the family strengths, the strengths-based approach, that it was really important that this framework be based on evidence-based practice. All the research that supports this approach said we need to look at what happens, what makes sense in a positive sense. And we need to make this happen based on what early care and education programs already do. We're not looking at devising some new program or looking at some new something, but let's look at where our kids and families already are. And it needs to be understandable to many people because prevention is about all of us, not just about parents or families. These are the protective factors that the center went about identifying. And actually what they did after this, I'm assuming they sat around and thought about this a lot. Then they actually went and looked around the country for exemplary or quality programs that exhibited some things. And so there was this paradigm shift. Using a logic model, they started at the end. This is what we want to achieve. We want to have child abuse and neglect prevention. We know that the protective factors include things like parental resilience. This is the single most common factor that's identified in child abuse prevention literature. And it's about developing that empathy for self and others through caring relationships. This is the most important thing that we can do to prevent child abuse and neglect. Well, this isn't in order.
It isn't.
The knowledge of parenting and child development. We know that parents who abuse their children often have inappropriate expectations about their children's abilities, and they can respond to their children's behavior in excessively negative ways. The concrete supports in times of need, that programs that exhibit this are able to offer support to parents in concrete ways, whether it's looking for housing assistance, helping parents look for where jobs happen, where they can look for job opportunities. Those are just some of the ways that concrete supports are there. Social connections and the social and emotional competence of children. And when you have all those protective factors, the next thing that the center did was they looked at, how do early care and education programs play out those protective factors? And voila, here are the things that those programs do. They facilitate friendship. We see early care and education programs sponsoring activities for parents like potlucks, classes, and volunteer opportunities. They strengthen parenting by offering support groups, opportunities to meet with teachers, provide home visits to families. They respond to family crises. Many programs consult with mental health clinicians and other community resources who are knowledgeable about child behavior. They link families to services and opportunities. Again, the job trainings and educational programs are examples of this. They value and support parents. In many programs, what the center found was actually space set aside in the center for parents to come and visit and sit and talk with the teachers. The programs facilitate children's social and emotional development. They, in the classroom, certainly promote the ideas of caring and sharing to children. And they also additionally support children who may have challenging behaviors, which is an issue in early care and education programs are really young children. We find that 38% of children in Alaska, 38% of children in child care programs specifically have been asked to leave because of their behaviors. And finally, these programs observe and respond to early warning signs of child abuse and neglect. So while all early care and education programs are mandatory reporters to our child protective services programs, in addition, these programs do more. They work with families, they support them, they work with their staff to train them to spend time observing children and helping parents make those reports when they need to happen. So in summary, that's a lot of information, but again, just to say that early care and education programs can really be a source, a primary source of information and support for families, for parents. They are a connector, I would say, to all of those outside services and supports, and they're an early warning system. Skipped one. So about 2.5 years ago, we were asked to apply for this 2 years of technical assistance to the center, along with 28 other states. Alaska was selected, along with the 6 other states listed here, to participate in 2 years of technical assistance, and Shirley will tell you more about that.
One of the things that we were required to do, and appreciated actually doing, is developing a leadership team to develop or to steer this project in Alaska. So as you can see, we had a broad range of folks representing a variety of programs and divisions in the state. So everywhere from Office of Children's Services to the Child Care Program to Child Care Resource and Referral Networks, the Prevent Child Abuse America chapter, a variety of folks, as well as a parent representative on this group. So the leadership team meets, and we steer the project, and had developed these goals in the beginning. Two of the goals really have to do with early care and education programs. One, we wanted to, with our project, highlight the significant role that they play with child abuse and neglect prevention. And we also wanted to engage them, in turn, as key stakeholders in this effort. We also wanted to look at the relationship and the partnership that we have with child protection and early care and learning programs, because there's a lot of rich ground there in terms of serving kids if we participate together. And last but not least, we really wanted to see what it would take to move this model across the state. What we hoped to learn from our pilot was really, how do you do this and what does it take to make this happen? So what we chose to do in Alaska is to start with some pilot programs. We initially identified 6 programs across the state to become pilot programs. One of those had to leave the program last summer. So these are the 5 that remain with us. They went through an application process. And one of the first things that we hope to establish is that they were already doing quality child care. Because what we hoped to do with this project was really to focus on extending the family support piece rather than starting with child care that we really needed to focus quality with. We also wanted to have a variety of models, and certainly as you can see, we did that. In Anchorage, we have Boys and Girls Club. This was focused on their 0-5 program, although I think the impacts of strengthening families have really spread to their older children. It's a large program, and really they felt like they had a long way to go with family support and certainly have come a long way. Open Arms is a very large child care program. It's a faith-based program in Fairbanks, serving over 200 children. We have Juno Montessori School, and Lupita Alvarez is with us today to share a little bit about how that impacted her program. In Anchorage, we also had the Rural Cap Child Development Center, which is required to serve at least 51% low-income families. And we had Bristol Bay Head Start Program, which had, I believe, five villages that were connected to this program. So it gave us a real range of models and regions of the state, so we could really see the differences in terms of how this would be played out. And, of course, what we found with those pilot sites is that it did play out very differently. What they chose to do and how they chose to implement this framework was very different based on what their families' needs were in their community. Just a little bit about what pilot sites were sort of committed to doing with us. The Strengthening Families National Model has what they call a self-assessment. And it's a way of going through all of these protective factors we talked to, and it's answering questions about how your program is doing. So before the program started, they did the self-assessment, and then they've just recently completed a post-self-assessment. And again, it's totally subjective, but they did have to have a team of their director, staff, and parents to complete that. With those plans, then, programs could see, while we're not doing so great in this area, we'd like to improve in this area, they developed implementation plans. They came in, received orientation about the Strengthening Families program. We also had two other face-to-face trainings. And I think one of the real keys to this project was this learning network of teleconferences. Because once the group came together, we developed some relationships, we understood the framework, and then month by month we had calls focused on the protective factors. It was a way of keeping programs focused on what they were doing, focused on families, and continuing to build the momentum. We were able to find some funding for each of these programs to have a $10,000 mini grant to implement. And we received some funding from the Alaska Children's Trust, some from the SEED Project. We had a small amount of money from Title V, and then a little bit of funding through the early care and education, I'm sorry, the early childhood comprehensive systems, which I should know since that's who I am. I wanted to share just a little of the data that's just come out, and I wish I could say we've analyzed this a little closer, but in lieu of that, when we looked at the changes between the pre-self-assessment and the post-self-assessment, and we were having, we had five programs that did both of these, we looked at how many had increased from what they rated themselves as poor or good and moved to excellent. So in these categories, as you can see, for example, we had five programs that showed improvement in that way in facilitating friendships and mutual support. So the number out to the left represents the number of programs that had made at least a 30% gain in that area. And what I would caution you with as you look at this right now is that it doesn't really say where programs began. So, for example, under strengthening parenting, you may have had programs rating themselves high to begin with, which is why you don't see the gains in that area. We also, in one of our program, had a change of directors, and so since this was subjective, she may have rated herself differently. But we are going to go back to analyze this a little more closely. And what we would like to do at this point in time is, Madam Chair, is to introduce Lupita Alvarez, who's the director of the Juno Montessori School. And we've asked Lupita if she'd just spend a few minutes sharing how this has sort of impacted her program.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to being here.
State your name for the record.
My name is Lupita Alvarez, and I'm the director of the Juno Montessori School here in Juno. And when we were selected to participate in the Strengthening Families program, it was very exciting for us because as we were working on the assessment plan, we realized that many of those things that were expected to be doing in an early childhood program that we were doing, but that there were definitely areas where we could improve and that we could be more intentional in order to be more successful. And we definitely focus on helping families to network with each other, to establish opportunities where the families could come together, find out what their strengths are and how they could help each other, and helping them make connections. And if families had certain preferences or needs or hobbies that they wanted to share, that there would be an opportunity for them to find out, oh, so-and-so likes fishing and we can go together, or we can share childcare, or a variety of opportunities that came about. This actually help in the whole sense of community that we develop in our program, where we got to a point just recently. We had a Valentine's tea where the children would invite their parents to come and see some of the activities that they did in the classroom, and then serve them some tea and other refreshments. And we had 100% participation, which is totally outstanding, to have every parent attending this event, which was a big deal for the children. So to me, that it's an incredible show of success, that the families are connecting with each other, that they know each other. And we had a situation where a parent was suddenly she got sick with leukemia, diagnosed with leukemia, and it was very sudden when this happened, and the response of the entire community was unbelievable. People immediately came with miles so that they could fly down to Seattle, people volunteering to take care of their children, the different ways of support that was available was just incredible, and it took no time for all this to come together. So that has been definitely something that shows how we can, in a program, help people establish connections, valuable relationships that go beyond the simple drop off my kid and go to work. They definitely have gotten a better understanding that it's so important to establish those connections with the teachers, but also with the parents of their kids' friends and the people that they live with day to day, because they spend so much time. Some of them, they spend 10 hours a day in a center, and the connections that they make are, you know, their peers, and now we are extending to their families, and so that's been very successful. We also focus this part of the grant into utilizing mental health services. And this has been really invaluable, because we've been able to connect children with special needs with services in the community. This was definitely an area that we had been doing some work on, but we made also big improvements, and that I consider was very valuable for those families as well, to be able to have services for their children that have, you know, some special needs. And again, for our program to be able to either meet the needs or to find, you know, services, better services for those children, it makes a big difference for the families. And we also had some little frustrations, the fact that we identify needs for these families and to know that there were services not readily available for them, whether it was for funding reasons or for, you know, lack of services themselves. So that was also frustrating to know that, yes, here we have children with these special needs, but we can't afford to have a special aid in our program, and the parent can't afford that, and there's no funding available. And so that's, an area that I think that we need to do something about it. But, you know, just to be able to identify, and in some cases, you know, being able to direct people to services has been wonderful. Yeah. I could go on and on.
We probably should have just turned this all over to Lupita, because it makes a lot of sense when you hear it, how it really plays out on the ground. But programs did very different things with this model. We had a program who was offering dinners for parents and children, like for $2 a night on Wednesday night, and nobody was coming. And it was our faith-based program, actually, and they were advertising it through the church. And then they changed it to say, this is open arms dinner for open arms families. They started having 140 children and parents from their child care stay for dinner on Wednesday night, knowing that busy parents didn't want to go home and cook, or they could pick up their dinner and they could go. Their program also started what they called the Parent Navigators program, where when a new parent came into the program, they were assigned an experienced parent. So if there were questions they had, they weren't comfortable talking with staff or felt more comfortable with the parent, somebody could guide them through the program. They'd also started a program called Parent Coaching, where they had professionals who would be willing to work one-on-one with families about parenting. And their program in particular, too, they had a lot of families who had been deployed to Iraq, and so now there's a single parent at home really struggling and needed extra support and services. Our Head Start programs, who are already doing family support, that's a key ingredient there, found that the model really helped them put the why we do all this stuff together. It was, why are we doing all of these plans, support? It's because it's prevention-oriented. It strengthens all families. And, of course, in rural Alaska, the cultural nights, the family nights were just a huge success for them. Boys and Girls Club, some of the interesting things, or I think what was unique for them, is really how they changed their physical setup, where they really did use some of their mini grant to create an environment where parents would feel comfortable to come in, hang out, use the parent library, talk to staff members. How they displayed the learning that was happening with the children changed so they would just pull parents into that process. So again, how programs implemented this in many ways is very different. And we talk about small but significant changes, that it doesn't have to be something that no one's ever thought of before. It doesn't have to be out of the box, but it's those small things that create a sense of community for families where they're already going because their children are there, which is really a key for this. Some of the things I would like to share with you, in addition to what the leadership team is doing with the pilot sites, is we're also working with our child protection programs and how they relate to these early care and learning programs. So we've brought the regional groups together and had conversations about how can we partner better, how can we exchange information about children. So child care, for example, knows if a child's been placed in foster care and is going to be moving out of their program or perhaps moving into their program. How can we do some cross-training so all parties understand how trauma impacts young children and how you help support and address their needs? Did a lot of brainstorming about that. We also talked a lot about just our processes in terms of funding child care with our foster parents and biological parents that need child protective services, child care. We're also working, how do we spread this model statewide? And one of the strategies is how do we work with our universities and our training for early care and learning programs? So we have programs now, at least two of the campuses are starting to embed the protective factors language in some of their social work or early care and learning courses. We have our first ever BSW social work student who's doing their practicum in a child care center. So we're making some inroads that way with the Child Development Associate Certification Training. Our curriculum now will include some of this protective factors language. We're also working with the Child Care Program in discussions about how we might embed this in some of our licensing, for example, in Illinois, as we had heard, for them. In their licensing, if you have a child care license, you've at least agreed to complete the self-assessment, so you have to take a look at what you're doing with families. We are trying to get the word out on this, so when we have an opportunity to present at workshops or conferences, we do that. Last spring in April, we had what was called the Partnership in Early Childhood Conference, We had up our national speakers, Judy Langford and Jean McIntosh from the Center for the Study of Social Policy, as our keynotes, and they, along with our pilot sites, conducted some workshops. And last but not least, we're just really starting to approach how can we expand this model statewide. Our leadership team is going to be focused on this now that we're back from our meeting in Chicago and are starting to pull in our post data from our pilot sites. I won't go into this too much, but we really do, if we want to promote better outcomes for children, and particularly if we understand the biology behind this toxic stress and what happens when kids are exposed to maltreatment, we really have to look at a broad range of policies, and that's about how do we support families, how do we strengthen our programs, and that's a wide range of things from housing to child early care and learning. And last but not least, I'm sure you've heard this from many sources, our young kids right now need champions. The research is out there. You know, for those of us who have worked with early childhood for 25 years, we've known the difference. Now we have the brain scans, we have the research to really show us how important these early years are.
So you have given us a lot of information, and it's very valuable information. I'm sure that members might have some questions. I thought maybe if we had time at the end, you might just tell us about the program that we spent the day in Chicago, mm-hmm. and went to the classrooms and all the things that we did, and how we were able to speak with the parents and hear how they felt about the program and how they had improved in certain areas that they gave that credit to that center that they were a part of. And in that particular center, it was from babies all the way up to high school students. A very wonderful program.
I have to agree. It was just it was exciting to be there to actually see how this could be implemented. And we have to say that Illinois has sort of been the star of the Strengthening Families movement. They have embraced this in every way possible. The Carol Richardson Center that Senator Davis is referring to is it's a large program. It serves, I believe, over 500 mm-hmm. children. It has a couple of different locations, and they serve really birth through teenagers. So they have early care and learning programs, they have after school programs, they have programs for teenagers and youth. But what is really astounding about the program is you walk in, you know exactly what their philosophy is in terms of supporting families and the importance of strengthening families. They have on-site GED classes for parents, they have English as a second language classes for parents. They have social workers there to help families in times of need and to get the supports that they need. Along with that, they are work very hard to have a qualified staff. They have low ratios in their classrooms, so they have three teachers in their child care programs, which makes it easy then to pull out at least one teacher to continue her professional development. Any staff member we talked to, at least was my experience, if you ask anything about this philosophy, about the importance of families, it was in their heart and soul. It was clearly the philosophy of not just the director, but every staff member there. It was a good example, I think, of how this program had put in multiple sources of funding, both for adult education classes, for teenage programs, for young children and family support, and really built a community around the program. It was exciting to see that.
It really was. Are there any comments from committee members?
is there a difference in the development of infants or young people, young children, in rural Alaska, say, to urban Alaska? Is there a difference? I've been over in Asia quite a bit, and they claim that the fatty acids, omega, in salmon helps the young develop in the brain in the early. I was just wondering if you've got any information on that.
I don't have any research on that. But we're hearing a lot about omega-3. I know I'm starting to look for my fish oil. But I think your comment through the chair to Senator Cowdery is really nutrition, for example, is very important to young children. In rural Alaska, I used to work in rural Alaska, and anemia was a huge problem for young children. We know anemia is a problem when it comes to learning. That all of those things play in, and we shouldn't probably start with birth. We need to look at what happens prenatally also and how nutrition impacts things.
And a little follow-up on the...
Yes, you may.
We have some pages that we hire from all over the state, you know, to be here to experience government up close and this and that. And one of the pages was down here. They never had TV as a child on purpose. And the thing that was strange to me, they had never seen the Tonight Show. and they made it, I'm going to watch Johnny or Leno tonight. I'm going to watch him. I've never seen it before.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not saying that's bad, but on the same thing, I'm a firm believer that TV, modern day TV, doesn't do our kids a lot of good. I mean, and I'm not saying, you know, when I... Because I walk 200 miles a day to school and back, you know, has any effect on it. But I think that there's a big influence with our TV and the movies that we have now on our young people. And I don't think it's in the best interest of our society. Mm-hmm. So just about that.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Senator Davis. Appreciate your presentation, and as I was sitting here listening to it, I was trying to think of something, some things to ask you about and how to do it tactfully. And the concern, I guess, that I have is, and this is a great program, and I just wonder how we press this down into the area where people are not taking their kids to the Montessori school or to the faith-based situation, and that is the last thing in their consideration. They're leaving their kid with whoever's still hanging around the house as they're going out to find drugs or maybe go to a job. Hopefully, at best, that's the situation. How do we broaden the program to actually have the impact on those? Because I spent some time at elementary schools, you know, talking to teachers and stuff about what they see. And they're not seeing the kids that have been to the Montessori school coming to them with, you know, in Fairbanks with no coat on in the morning and no gloves and no lunch brought and nothing like that, picked up by maybe a relative. So how, like I said, this is great. This helps, you know, there's lots. But I see a lot of teenage pregnancy as well, kids having kids. And how do we drive these programs down into the area where maybe it has more beneficial impact on a greater number of people that could use it? And I'm not saying that all low-income parents are bad parents, but I'm saying sometimes there just isn't the ability to afford some of the things, because we had, you know, testimony that daycare is difficult to find. But those that are actually doing that aren't the problem. It's the ones that are neglectful to begin with that are creating a lot of the problem. So long question, maybe not even a question, but the concern I have is, how do you drive these types of programs into where they can do the most benefit and in the long run save us the social problems that then come along at early ages?
Through the chair to Senator Thomas. A couple of things. One is, we do have a number of course, low-income families who are in using child care, and so that is one way to approach them. But what is interesting and what is exciting to me about the Strengthening Families piece is, if you take the child abuse prevention framework and you think about protective factors and building those supports, to me you can take that anywhere that interfaces with families. You could put this in early intervention programs, any family support program. If you had pediatricians or medical offices who so desired, they could implement these strategies. So I think we have to think differently about where do children and families show up. We know they show up in childcare. At least 20% of our young children are in at least identified slots for childcare or Head Start. We know another place where families often show up are in medical offices. So those are two places where kids and families already go that you could implement some of these strategies. And it doesn't have to be early childhood. I think schools certainly could take a look at how to implement this model.
You may continue.
If I may, just that's what I'm getting at, you know. And every time you start trying to affect the the curriculum in a school and have some impact, people claim that you're pushing your political or your moral views upon others and separation of church and state. So I just, that's the concern I see, that if it started basically and we'd gotten away from some of that type of instruction in high school with young girls and boys as well, indicating, you know, the problems that can be avoided in some cases by having children young, and if you do have, this is what is going to be your responsibility anyhow. So for what it's worth anyhow. Thank you.
If I'm allowed, I'd like to comment on the implementation of the program as I saw it in our particular program. Many of the things we already were doing, it was part of our curriculum and of the plan of our program. It's really a matter of being intentional, making sure that what you're doing, you are really, you know, putting an emphasis and its clarity about it. We meet with parents every time we have a new parent. You know, we need to learn about the family and the child and so on. Well, it just took a little bit of extra, you know, thinking about what else do I need to know or can I do for this family and what their needs are, and do I know other families that may have a connection? Can I help them make this connection and foster a relationship? And so in that, I think just knowing that you have the tools, that you just need to use them more purposefully, that you can have better results. However, there is also parts of the implementation where you actually need extra staff time, because when you have, you know, the plan to have the teachers meet with each parent individually and have conferences in a regular basis so that you're actually, you know, checking on how the children are doing, if there are any concerns, that you really take the time to take care of those things, that actually requires somebody else to go in the classroom while I can pull a teacher to meet with a parent. And so there is a cost to that part. And so I think it is, there is some financial constraint to be able to apply the program, but there are parts that, you know, you already have to do. It's just, you know, that you can be more intentional. So there's a little bit of both, you know, that you can implement if you know that this is available, and but there may be, if there was some funding available, that you can actually have more of these pieces be expanded to reach, you know, a bigger group of people. When we do parenting classes, we normally do it on in a volunteer basis, and if you want to do that on a regular basis, it might be a little hard for a teacher to do, you know, a class once a month for a school year. So it adds up. So you can only do so much or expect anyone to do that on a volunteer basis. And so I think that we need to consider both situations. The other thing I wanted to comment about the television, I agree with you, and one of the issues that we have is children between the ages of, you know, 0 to 6, they are like sponges. They absorb everything, they learn everything, and there is no judgment on their part. Anything they see is. That's reality. So if I see on TV people punching each other because that's what they do, then you see them on the playground or in the classroom punching each other because that's what you do. And so a lot of behavioral issues are because that's what the children are absorbing. And it's definitely television at a horrible impact. And I wish we could ban televisions for children 0 to 6.
I agree with that.
Absolutely.
I had a, if I may.
Yes, you may.
Doing the, we had a flood up in the Willow area, Willow Creek. And my daughter lives up there, and she was telling me, so I kind of adopted one of the families to help out. And anyway, the father was working to get him the house built again. He was a carpenter, but they were staying in a one room. There were three kids. I think the oldest girl was about 8 or 9, and it went down from that. And the family of five were living in one room. So my daughter went over and asked the little girl, Christmas time, what would you like for Christmas, you know? And her answer was she wanted to be warm, you know. But she said, I can't take, we don't have any room for anything. She says, I don't want anything because we have no room for it. And I thought that was a pretty mature attitude of that. And so anyway, we kind of helped them out on some lumber and things for the father to go ahead and build, getting a place built. But they were a very poor family, and but they didn't ask for a TV, didn't ask for things that some of my grandkids would have asked for, you know, and this and that. So they are some rewards for being poor too, you know, I think. And another story, if I could, one of our pages, I chair World Trade, and one about 5 or 10 years ago, we had two people over here from Russia, and one was a pilot in his real life, but they were both in politics now, and one of them was a teacher. So I inherited them for one day to show them Anchorage and everything, so I took them out to a home-built airport near Anchorage and let them see all the home builds. And I took the other one to a family up in the hillside that did homeschooling, the teacher. Well, the kids were all over you. When you're in there, them kids are just, they'll fight to sit next to you, you know. And so they was over there, and the father, well, the question came up about homeschooling, what's the standard? And so the father picked up a can of oil, a motor oil, and he asked his 7-year-old to read what's on that can. And that was all the specs and everything in there. And then, what does SAE mean in this, you know? And the kid knew everything. Well, they were really impressed with that. But then the guy from Russia, the teacher, he said, what do you do for social things since they're all here? And John said, in a straight face, he says, all about once a month, we take them all down, the kids all downtown Anchorage, and turn them loose and let them find their way home. And they believed that. And the next time I was in Russia, they brought that up. That same guy brought it up, and I couldn't believe that they really believed that. But, you know, that was the way it was. Anyway, I'm sorry to take up the time.
That's quite all right. Back to your presentation. It was very good and helpful. You talked about the six states that's involved in your program. Aren't you at the end of that grant?
We are.
You're into the third year?
Yeah, we are, Madam Chair. As far as our formal pilot project with the Center for the Study of Social Policy, that has come to an end. And what has happened is the National Alliance of Children's Trust Funds have also funded some new states as pilots, and there are some of us that have been chosen then to also be part of a learning collaborative. So although, once again, that doesn't involve any funding, we are connected with other states and will continue to meet with them once a month telephonically. In May, there's going to be a national conference in, I believe it's in San Diego, and Alaska's invited to take a team to that, and we would love to have anybody join us to go down to that. But it's really putting together a variety of disciplines, policymakers, practitioners, folks who are doing it on the ground to join in May. So it's really They're calling it a national movement because it's one of those things that has made so much sense to so many states that even if they haven't been selected as a pilot site or received any funding, they're starting to adopt these principles.
As we attended that workshop, it was mentioned that there's a National Children's Trust Fund mm-hmm. and that we were on the brink of being a member of that. Has that come to be yet?
Do you want to talk about the National Trust?
Yes, Madam Chair. Alaska is a member of the National Alliance of Children's Trust. It's a membership organization for every state that has a trust. And as you all probably know, each state has a trust. And Alaska, we have an executive director, and she participates, I think, monthly on audio calls with regard to the National Alliance. And they have meetings, I think, once a year. But the Alaska Children's Trust, through their executive director and their board, have been very supportive of the Strengthening Families movement here and actually sit on the leadership team. So we expect to keep moving forward and broadening our leadership team and bringing more people along. So,
And I think that's wonderful, but is there ever going to be a time that you feel that you're going to be able to come before us to say that you're in need of money to broaden the program into more sites or more programs? You think that we'll just find the way we are at this point?
We definitely need more money. I'm sorry to jump in, but education, just that we need funding for education, especially in the early years. We don't have what is needed, especially when we're talking about reaching those. Reaching the families and reaching where the problems are in those teenagers that are having children, all this needs, it's not going to happen by magic. You definitely need to have more prepared people and qualified people to be able to address this concern seriously.
I appreciate your statement. It's true that we need to do that. And I guess this is a good time also that you're presenting that we have a lot of the groups in town that are here for training youth and parents, and a lot of them were here earlier and had to leave. I think some are going to be in town until tomorrow. There's lots of good things being said about some of the early childhood programs that we have and what we need to do to strengthen those programs. So you're not just a voice in the wilderness that's out there saying, yeah, we have this program and it's working and it's good. You need to know about it. I'm glad that we have it on tape today so that other people other than us here in this building can see it. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that might help you spread the word out more. Yeah, I know you're going to present tomorrow mm-hmm. on the House side.
Right.
And that is always good.
And Madam Chair, and for the record, I'm Claudia Shanley with the Office of Children's Services. I'm glad that you mentioned that. We do work really closely with the other entities, many of whom you have seen this week, and particularly focusing not only Head Start, the Ready to Read group, the Seed Council. I know they've all come before you, but we are working with them. And I think that it is safe to say that we are looking for creative ways within the Office of Children's Services, too, in our prevention programs for incorporating the Strengthening Families. So we know that we need to look within our primary prevention efforts we have going on for how we can further this. And I think that I think the department thus far has been very supportive in what we're trying to do, and hopefully we'll be able to continue it. So thank you.
We hope so.
Madam Chair,
yes?
If I could just go back to one comment about the other groups. One of the things that's important to point out about Strengthening Families is that it needs to be, the family support piece needs to be connected to quality child care. In other words, you have to have that to attach it to. It's poor quality child care. You got to start with quality child care and add family support to it. And on the other hand, if you have quality child care and you don't build in this family support piece, you don't get the impact from the Strengthening Families. So it's really very much connected.
Thank you. Senator Dyson, would you like to make a comment or a statement or ask any questions?
Thank you.
You're welcome. If there's no one else, is there anyone in the audience that need to come before us? If not, we want to thank you for your presentation and taking the time to come and visit with us, and hope that you will keep informing us of the things that you're doing so that we will be able to pass the word around and maybe bring more families in to your particular type of program. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We'll adjourn the meeting at 2:45.